My name is Clay Newcomb, and this is a production of the Bear Grease Podcast called the Bear Grease Render, where we render down, dive deeper, and look behind the scenes of the actual Bear Grease Podcast. Presented by FHF Gear, American-made, purpose-built hunting and fishing gear that's designed to be as rugged as the places we explore. Guys, we've got an exclusive Bear Grease discount code for FHF Gear. That's Fish Hunt Fight Gear. I've been using their products for the last year, and I love carrying my gear in a chest rig or my binos in their bino harness. It's easier and more accessible than a backpack, and it doesn't get in the way when I'm riding my mule. For a limited time, you can head over to fhfgear.com/bear grease, and listeners to this here podcast get a discount on purchases for your FHF gear system, and you can see how I build my gear system. So go to fhfgear.com/bear grease for a special code if you're buying stuff from FHF gear. Check it out. Fish Hunt Fight, FHF gear. Say that again, Dan.
I think we should make a podcast that's disgruntled render participants.
Because there's a growing number.
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
Is there strife on the team?
Well,
not
unofficial. That classic clueless leadership asks, is there strife on the team? Well, is a fat dog heavy? We're barely hanging on.
Let's just say there's been some meetings in private.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I had to take a few weeks off. Players-only meeting?
I had to take a few weeks off to recover.
No, we're just forming a union. We've unionized.
Hey, welcome to the Bear Grease Render. Speaking of the render, what did you guys think of the last render?
When we got booted out without notice?
What?
That time.
It stung a little.
I had
taken the whole week off.
Hey, this is a safe place, okay?
We can talk about what's on our hearts,
okay?
It's kind of like watching your kids go to family Christmas somewhere else.
Yeah.
And
Dan has a Hey, listen.
I had some very good feedback
from that one, and then I had also some guys that were like, never let those guys on there again. Bring back the guys we love. And that was you guys.
We really like those guys.
Oh, they were great.
I listened to a lot of it.
It was nice of them to fill in.
Yeah.
I'll say that.
Well, see, what people don't understand is that when you're in showbiz, you got to do what showbiz has to do. We had been hunting and we had to make a render. And that was part of the plan from the beginning, is at different times we would have a full new crew.
Well,
like if I was somewhere in a camp and I would just fill it in. So it was super fun.
I heard it, and 5 minutes into it, I thought, this is Clay's fault. Because clearly you had made them so uncomfortable that they...
Hey, okay.
They're really nice.
We had been pounding.
That Clay had made really uncomfortable.
Yes.
We had been pounding the dirt for days. Days. And we really were tired, but it was great. It was great. Mark and having all the guys on there was fun. I had a lot of people say they really liked it. But it's great to have everybody back. Hey, let me do introductions. Josh Landbridge Spillmaker to my left. Good to see you, Josh.
It's good to be seen, honestly.
Hey, we're going to play some music later.
Are you serious?
Like real live music, and you're a part of it.
Okay, I'm in.
Hey, we have one guest, and I'm going to come back to him, as is our custom. To Josh's left, Dr. Daniel Roop.
Hey, everybody.
Hey, Dan Roop has been killing some deer.
I have.
Did you know that, Dad?
Yeah, I've talked to him about it.
He's killed two deer with his bow.
In our side meetings, we've talked about several things.
There's no rift between Dan and I.
Nope. Thick as thieves over here.
Mm-hmm. Well, congrats on the deer.
Thanks a ton. Yeah.
So this is your first year bow hunting in a while, though.
First year bow hunting in probably 12 or 13 years.
How many have you killed?
Two.
Really?
Yeah.
I knew about one of them. I didn't know about the other one.
I got a little doe the other night, about 4 nights ago.
You got a secret honey hole? I almost took a doe out here driving up here tonight.
Really?
Yeah.
Doe meat's the best meat.
It's in the freezer as of tonight.
Hey, it's a big deal to kill a deer with a bow.
Man, I'm so thankful. It's been really fun. I've got a good friend of mine, gives me a little spot to hunt on, and just wonderful.
That's awesome.
Yeah. That's real good. It's hard to find a good friend.
to Dan's left, Gary Newcomb. Hey. Dad, it's been a while since you've been here.
It's been a while.
It's been probably 4 or 5 weeks.
It has been.
You know, there's been a couple of Gary Newcomb for president campaigns going on. Were you aware of this?
No, I wasn't. You know, I've applied for unemployment, but
didn't work.
It didn't work.
So now you're going to run for president?
I'll put
a sticker on my car.
Have you done any hunting, Dad?
None. You know, I've been shooting my bow. I got my equipment ready. I've got my scent lock ready to go. But when I get up in the morning, I think, why am I doing this, man?
And so you don't go, huh? You just stay home?
Yeah, but I really have plans of killing a monster buck this year.
Good.
Did you hear the shout-out that you got from Mark Kenyon?
No.
I mean...
Oh.
On the render.
On the render, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay, so my dad, Gary Newcomb, and Mark Kenyon, who's Meat Eater's whitetail guru, his podcast and what he does is branded under Wired to Hunt. And he has one of the top whitetail podcasts in the country, if not the top whitetail podcast. So me and Mark always have this fun thing going where he is like a guru. He's like a gear nerd and tactics. I mean, like his mind is like a gearbox when it comes to all this stuff. What Mark wouldn't know is that my mind used to be that way and I was liberated. And my mind used to be that way because Gary Newcomb's mind is that way. And so I grew up under the whitetail Jedi master, ultimate scent control, ultimate tree stand setup, ultimate gear guy, ultimate bow tinkerer. I mean,
and
Gary Newcomb,
have all that leftover stuff from 25 years ago.
Yeah, and then Dad gave a bunch of stuff to Josh.
Josh stole a lot of that stuff.
I did steal that flashlight. I admit I stole the flashlight for 6 years, but I gave it back.
You did give it back.
6 years.
Streamlight.
So Dad used to be, well, still is, big time in the gear. And Dad and I have talked about this privately, so we've worked through this. But that kind of impacted me into not really liking gear. Gear's like a necessary evil.
You're like the prodigal son.
Yeah, maybe so. I said all that to say Mark and Dad got along great.
The son he never had.
Yeah, I thought a lot of Mark. That whole crew was just extremely nice. I mean, I just enjoyed every one of those guys.
Yeah, yeah.
By the way, Mark said he might get me a piece of gear.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Ooh.
And he said, if I don't get it, to tell you.
Okay. So, Mark, we need to tell Mark to get you some gear.
Yeah.
So, the way this worked is we hunted down around where Dad lives for a film that you'll see one day through Meat Eater of Mark hunting public land down in the mountains. So, I didn't even tell Mom and Dad too many specifics about when we were going to be down in their hometown. Because we weren't going to have time to go see him, so I didn't want him to think much about us being there. So we go there, Dan, and at like 8 o'clock, we were delayed. It was like 8 o'clock at night, and we were about to have to go out in the woods and set up our full camp in the dark, and then break it all down and go hike back in at daylight. And so I said, you know what? I bet we could stay with Juju. And so I called my mom and I was like, what are you doing, Juju? And she's like, oh, we're just, you know, getting ready for bed or whatever she said, you know. I was like, how would you feel about 6 of us coming and staying the night with you?
Right now, in 1 hour. Yeah.
And she said,
the prodigal son returns.
She said, what do you think?
Kill the
mom,
fatted calf.
What would a Southern mom say if that happened?
Well, come on.
Okay. Well, she said that, but she expressed some worries too.
Have y'all eaten?
Yes. I don't have any food. I hadn't cooked, Clay. Stuff like that. And I was like, Juju, we've already eaten. We're full. We don't need any food. I don't have any food. Juju, we don't need any food. We're not hungry. Don't but I just don't have much food. Juju, we don't need any food.
Did she have food when you got there anyway?
She had a little bit. She did. Yeah. She scratched so much.
Is she talking about the house being a mess? All the house
okay,
is a mess.
I wasn't going to say it, but yeah, she's like, yep. She's like, the house is a mess. And the house was perfectly clean. And so we went over and stayed with mom and dad. It was a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah. It was nice. We really enjoyed it.
And then we stayed on the tail end of the trip, too, 5 days later.
Yeah, yeah.
We came back and stayed a night. And all the guys just loved mom and dad. They had a good time.
Yeah. What's not to love?
We actually recorded the render at their house.
That's what I was going to say. Oh. Has Clay taken you to his parents' house, Dan?
I have one time.
Oh, really? You've been down there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Years ago.
There. Well, I've been down there. I go down to see Gary.
Yeah. Okay.
We're buds.
You friends with Mark Kenyon?
Mark and I go way back. I've never met him. No. Mark's like the son I never had.
Hey, we've got a great podcast. I'm very excited about this. We're going to talk about the third and final kind of Southwest themed podcast. So this podcast was not just about Warner Glenn. It was about the Borderlands Jaguar. That's where we're going. So if you're new to The Render, which there's a lot of people that might be new to this, we produce a documentary style podcast. I haven't introduced our guest.
No.
Goodness gracious.
Or
Misty.
The replaceable totally one, blue. You know?
Okay. I've got to finish what I was going to say, and then we'll come back. I'm so sorry.
We'll come back to us.
The Bear Grease podcast is a documentary style podcast that we, you know, just put a ton of energy and effort into. The Bear Grease Render is this informal gathering of people where we talk about
less effort.
We talk about the podcast. So this is the Bear Grease Render you're listening to. Okay, to Gary's left, my lovely wife Misty Newcomb.
Great
Thank
to
you
be
for
here.
Being here.
Always good to be here.
Yeah.
Always good to be here.
Great. Okay, our mystery guest is my longtime friend. We go to church together. We're neighbors. Tyrell Dennison. Welcome, Ty.
Hey, glad to be here.
Man, this is I knew this day would come. That you would be on the render.
It's nice to be here. I'm glad to have gotten the invite.
Ty has been pretty instrumental in my career world. He really was. Ty was the one who, like 7 years ago, did you know this, Josh? We were producing that Bear Horizon video for Bear Hunting Magazine.
Which, if people have not watched, they should go back and watch because it was
fantastic.
Man,
I'm embarrassed of some of that stuff.
Really? I love it. I still watch videos from
there. There's some really good content.
Yeah.
Well, so we were producing Bear Horizon videos. That's what we call it. I think in 2015 we started.
I thought it was fantastic. What are you talking about?
Yeah, some of it was good.
Better than a couple of renders I've heard.
And so, listen, Dan. Then we just had him on like Vimeo and like embedded him on our website. I didn't even know
what Vimeo was then.
That's what you did back in those days.
But I mean, I didn't know what Vimeo was until you said, hey, you can watch these videos on Vimeo.
Okay.
What's Vimeo?
Yeah, it's just a way to implant a video on a web page. Right. Well, then Ty one day walked up to me and said, Clay, you need to put your videos on YouTube. And I was like, nah. I mean, this was like 2015. This was like 7 years ago. So I was like, man, YouTube is for like cell phone videos and low quality content. And Ty said, not anymore. He said, this is the direction that the market's going.
Oh, Ty.
You got to put your stuff on YouTube. And he was adamant about it. And I did it. And within like a month, I had a viral video on YouTube. It was when that bear touched my arrow. Mm. And that video jump-started the Bear Hunting Magazine YouTube channel, which built it out. Anyway, so Ty Dennison has been influential. And Dang, Ty's always really good at giving me feedback.
Well, and I barely understand YouTube. Like, I'm not someone who's like following YouTubers. Like, the fact that people can just create content on YouTube, like in their rooms, still like breaks my brain. I'm just like, I don't know how people make millions on YouTube, but I'd seen enough quality content in like my areas of interest where I knew like, oh, there's stuff here besides just guys with their webcam talking about what's been going on the internet these days amongst the kiddos. It's just like, there's actually some really nice stuff around here. Yeah. And so it's just like, man, it'll get out there and people will share it for sure. And so, man, yeah. I was glad to hear that. It took off because it was good stuff. Needed to get out there. It still is.
Yeah.
Nothing to be ashamed of on that YouTube channel.
Well, I've learned inside of media is that you do stuff and then you go back and look at it and it's like a different version of who you are. And you're kind of,
yeah.
But no, there's some real good bear hunts on there. Some good whitetail hunts too. Speaking of whitetail hunts, I have something I want to show you guys.
Mm.
I have a little something to show you, boys.
Oh, look at that.
Look at that guy.
Look at that sucker.
That is a skull, a non-typical skull.
That is
a crazy
really
looking.
Unusual.
So this, by the time this render comes out, I will have put this picture on YouTube. On the Instagram.
YouTube for pictures, if you will.
This deer was walking around about 26 hours ago. I killed that deer in Oklahoma yesterday.
This is the one you were going after for days, right?
No, negative.
Negative? There was a different one?
Mm-hmm.
That was a different buck. This was the first time I hunted this property in Oklahoma. So let me tell you what we've been doing. For the last 7 days, Mark Kenyon, Spencer Newharth, Tony Peterson, and myself have been hunting. We're basically, Meat Eater is making a whitetail series that's going to come out like in 2 weeks. We're going to produce a bunch of episodes that document our hunts. And we were hunting in 4 different states. We actually hunted in, I think, 6 different states between the 4 of us.
In the last week?
In the last week.
Wow.
Yeah. I killed that deer on the last day of the hunt, man. Who can describe that rack to somebody?
It's... The one side is really clean and
it just has a typical five-point side.
Typical 5-point side. The other side looks like something out of a sci-fi fantasy movie.
Yeah.
Well, actually, it really doesn't know.
It doesn't really have a main beam.
Let's do a live measuring of that time.
It's like you melted the bottom.
How long is that spike? So basically, it has one very clean, typical 5-point side. The left side is just a spike of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 points.
And the two bottom ones are like horizontal.
Yeah.
That main beam
from the base
facing two different directions.
14 and a half inches.
13 and a quarter inches.
Nice.
That's 13 and a quarter.
Would that be the main beam?
You know, it would be a judgment call. That would probably be.
I would say it's the main beam, but.
Okay. And then this would be like the brow tine right here. We'll go from the burr. That's about 12 inches. So you're going to see pictures of this on Instagram. And on Instagram, it looks like a 140, 150-inch deer. It's not that big. It's this was a 3-year-old deer. I don't even know what the deer
would score. Was that a filter you used to make the deer look bigger?
It was just...
How does that work out?
It's just pictures antler make meat. Deer look about 20 inches bigger than they are. They just always do. But
there's
a
new app called Antler Me.
hey, that's a good-looking deer. I mean... I was expecting it to be less than that.
Really?
Based on what you said. I'm very impressed with that animal.
Man, yeah. it was a big body deer, and he came in. We had hunted 7 days and I never even saw a buck I would have shot in 7 full days of hunting in good places. I hunted 3.5 days in Arkansas, 3.5 days in southeast Oklahoma. And I hunted with my friend Alvin Grigg, who he and his wife, like a week ago, he heard what I was trying to do and he said, "Hey, come hunt our place."
Oh, that's awesome.
Super generous. And that I went down there and they rolled the red carpet out for me. And he hadn't hunted much out there, so he didn't really know he hadn't been out there much this year. But he knew the good pinch points on this property. And anyway, I killed that deer after 3 days, and we hadn't seen very many deer until this deer came in. But man, he marched in just like on a mission and shot him at about 22 yards yesterday afternoon. Hit him far back, Dad. I told Alvin, I said, when I was a boy learning how to bow hunt,
you'd have got a whooping for that.
Well, you know what? I told him when we were young, you preached us not to hit him in the shoulder. And to this day, I'm over 40 years old, and if I hit a deer a little off, it's slightly back. I've killed a lot of deer with a liver shot, and it's because I have deeply ingrained into my default substructure of action is to aim far back from the shoulder, which produces a liver shot deer. Liver shot deer is no big deal. You just give them 2+ hours, sometimes
longer.
Longer.
Yeah.
And but that deer ran 120 yards and was dead as a hammer. It bled very little, though, because it was a broadside shot, and we were hunting these little post oak trees in southeast Oklahoma. And so we couldn't get up very high. And the deer was slightly kind of up a little bit of a grade. So I was almost shooting like straight at it. And so the arrow went in, the entry and exit were at the same level. And so by the time he filled up with blood, that it just didn't bleed much.
That's how it stuck in that tree almost flat. That photo that you put on, I guess, Facebook, and there's your arrow sticking in the tree. What was that?
Negative. Okay. I was just holding the arrow.
You just shot a tree?
The arrow was not sticking.
To teach
the arrow was not sticking in the tree.
The tree looked at you
I just
wrong.
Held the arrow out. I was just holding the arrow. You may want to look at that again. No. Oh, my goodness.
Was it trailing? Was it feeding? Was it, what was it doing?
It was, okay, so I'll tell you the whole story. It was a pinch point on the back of a big field corner where the deer come through. They were coming through the backside of that corner, and they were feeding. I mean, it's just the way we hunt down
here.
Is that
the only buck that you saw?
There was one other 8-point buck that I would have shot. It's too long a story, and you'll hear it in the video when we play the hunt. But I spooked a buck that was tending a doe when we came in there at like 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So anyway, it was a good hunt. There were multiple deer killed. I think I can say this. Between the four of us, there were 5 bucks killed in 7 days.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So it'd be a lot of action.
You know, if I'm listening to this, I want to know what kind of bow you were shooting, what kind of arrow, what kind of broadhead. Were you in a saddle? Were you in a, you know, what were you hunting out of?
Yeah.
I'd like to know that.
Okay.
Even though I know most of it, you were in a,
well,
hunting out
I
of a
was,
saddle.
I was in a new tethered saddle. We hunted in those things all week long. I mean, we made multiple all day sits in a tethered saddle.
Now, forgive me, I've not moved into the saddle realm yet. Are all saddles tethered, or is there
tethered
a
is a brand?
Okay,
there are multiple brands of saddles. Tethered is a brand, and they, as I understand it, were kind of the main
the gold
player,
standard. The leader in the.
They were kind of the leader that kind of reintroduced saddle hunting to the world. Saddle hunting used to, I mean, people have saddle hunted for a long time, but used to, it was kind of this, it was just kind of like this quirky thing that, you know, your weird neighbor did.
Does it not limit your ability to shoot a bow?
It makes it better.
Really?
I think it does. I mean, just you have more radius around that tree. You can almost shoot, if it was just a perfectly straight tree.
Uh-huh.
You could pretty much shoot 360 degrees around that tree. Probably 340. There's probably a little window, but you can spin all the way around the tree, and you just have to get comfortable kind of hanging off of it. But I just put on a saddle and went hunting and was fine. So it's not like you have to practice a ton, but you do have to get used to it. You have to get used to kind of hanging and just how it works and making it comfortable.
And you're not scooting up like you are in a climber. Like, how are you getting up there?
So you got to use sticks, or okay, you have to have a method of getting up a tree.
Right.
So you still have to get up a tree. That what it does is it eliminates you having to have multiple tree stands, and it eliminates you having to go in and hang a stand like the day before, or, you know, you're carrying in something real heavy. You carry a saddle and some sticks. But it's, you know, it sounds magical. But it, you know, it's hard to climb a tree no matter what you're doing.
Yep.
Humans weren't made to climb trees very good. It's hard to climb
a tree.
Depends
on the human.
You're pretty wiry, aren't you?
I don't know why I said that.
He has special gloves.
Special gloves.
I mean, 12-year-old me thought I was pretty well suited for it. I did it quite a bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
And do you have a traditional safety harness on as well?
Nope.
Or?
That's your safety harness.
Gotcha.
You can't come out of it, you know? Yeah.
I don't know. The older I get, the more nervous I get. I want to be up high. Huh? I love being up high. I get nervous when I'm up there.
Yeah.
I like being up high, but inevitably, when I get 20 feet up in a tree, I'm going to drop something.
You drop it.
And then I'm got to go back down. And then I got to go back up. So 16 feet. 16 feet is the sweet spot.
16.
Diminishing returns after
that. Dad, how high do you like to get?
You know, 20 feet. You know, when I was younger, I loved to hunt at 24. You know, I think that if you do 20 to 24 and you do a little bit of scent control, you can get away with lots of stuff when you get down 15, 16, 17, I mean, you got to be playing the wind all the time. You got to be real cautious. You get 20, 24.
You don't even have to turn the volume down on your YouTube videos. 24.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, that's been my experience.
Yeah.
And this guy that we've talked about that has killed so many big bucks in another state, I mean, he likes to hunt at 30 feet. I didn't have 30, the guts to get there, the 30
John
feet.
Eberhardt, you're talking about.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, 30 feet, you know, he loves to talk about scent lock and how good it is. Well, it's, you can, at 30 feet,
you can eat a pizza.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so I love this guy. He hunts kind of the way I hunt, except he's successful and I'm not.
It might be worth it just to take a cup of coffee up there with you.
But, you know, when he tells me what he does, I mean, it's a lot of stuff I do. And he likes to hunt food like I like to hunt. And he's better at bedding areas. He's really good. That's the real key to, seems to be right now, is to learn how to get in bedding areas and the edge of bedding areas. And I've never been too good at that.
Well, this part of the world that we live in is so thick, there's bedding could be everywhere. A lot of the places these guys are hunting is just so different than here.
Yeah.
I mean, it's agricultural fields, big open timber, and yeah, then the thickets or the CRP is very defined, and it's like the deer bed here, they feed here, and that is just not the way it is in the Ozark and Washita Mountains at all.
Yeah.
It's just not. So.
But you're shooting a prime bow.
Yeah, shooting a prime what Nexus kind of broadhead? 6. I'm shooting G5 dead meat broadheads. I like them. They fly good. It's an expandable head. I used to, for years, I was fixed blade hardcore. This year, I started shooting those, and they shoot good.
You told me 15 years ago to only use expandable
heads. That was back in the day, and then he went all fixed blade.
See, when I met Clay and started hunting with him, he was all fixed blade, so he talked me out of expandables. And now he's gone back to expandables.
The season
is like an emotional roller coaster here.
It's like bell bottoms.
It's like the rings on a tree. Why don't we go through how long you've known Clay by whether or not it was.
Why don't we go through all the places where I've flip flopped in my life, according to all you guys' eyes? No, I'm just kidding. No, my buddy Chris. My buddy Chris Roberts, when he first started hunting with me, Dad, I was hardcore scent control. You know, keep your clothes in plastic bags. Use baking soda. Use, you know, take a shower before.
I know.
You know, don't put on your clothes in your truck. I mean, hardcore.
That is still what I do.
Tell
you do not do that anymore.
How many times I rode in Gary?
I did that this morning.
We don't want to have this conversation.
I rode in Gary Newcomb's Jeep for years in my underwear to the stand.
that was just a practical joke, though. That was
that's what he wanted us to do in his Jeep.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
I believe
Josh.
Well, I don't know that this is the platform for this debate, but I basically, going back to what I said about Dad, like Dad was just methodical with everything he did, and that's the reason he was a good bow hunter.
Was. He's still here. He's still with us.
When Gary was around.
Just how much have you written off in this liberation?
No, about 12, 13, 15 years ago. About the time, Dan, you didn't hunt and were off away. I just scratched all scent control and went straight up woodsman, Josh Spillmaker. And turns out I kill more deer now than I did then. I don't know if it's a spurious correlation, meaning a correlation that's really not connected. Maybe I've gotten better places to hunt. Maybe I've got
just
luckier.
Just because Malachi's not here doesn't mean we don't know what a correlation is, Clay.
Yeah.
You say you went woodsman. Tell us.
Just hunting the wind. Like if there's a south wind, you hunt in a place where the deer are going to be north of you. It's just that simple. If there's a north wind, you hunt in a place where the deer are going to be south of you, and you just play the wind. Because what I found was I would do my scent control to the highest level that was possible for me and my skill set to do. And I'd go hunting and deer would still smell me. So I was like, why am I devoting my whole life to this? And now, Dad, you tell him why you do it, though. Because there's a good argument for using scent control stuff. I like to say that it's a hoax and it is the biggest way for outdoor companies to sell you a product that you have no way of knowing if it works or not because you can't smell that good with your nose. It's a good business to be in.
Wow. Bold statement.
I mean, it's just true. It's like, I'm going to sell you a product and you don't know if it works or not. And most of the time it doesn't, because you're in scent control and deer still smell you.
But
do you see what I'm saying?
You know, baking soda works. And you know, if you wash your clothes in laundry detergent, I mean, you know, you're putting all kinds of,
okay.
So, you know, I've got some soap that's unscented and it smells less scented than my scented soap.
Okay. Let me tell you something.
I will.
You're worried about your clothes.
Worried about your soul is what I'm worried about. Since when do you not care about sin?
Listen.
I don't even know who you are.
Listen to this.
A deer isn't scared of your shirt. A deer is scared of you, and you smell like a human. So it would essentially be like putting...
So you're trying to wash the human off of you.
It would be essentially like taking a burlap sack and filling it full of cow dung, and then being worried about the burlap sack, like scent control on the burlap sack. It's like, you're not... That burlap sack is not going to scare...
He's saying you smell like cow. Yeah. You know what?
Hear me out.
Okay, Tom.
What if instead of trying to wash the scent off, I just go like a full-on 14-year-old boy and just blast myself with Axe body spray? Yeah. You can't smell the human for all the Axe body spray.
Okay.
This
is cover scent.
Yeah, cover scent. Instead of cover scent, we go cover scent.
Chocolate Axe.
Now, I do believe in some cover scents. I've seen some cover scents that worked pretty good or confused or slowed deer's spook response down. To this day, every hunt this week, I tried out some new stuff. This Dan Fitzgerald deer dander, and I would pour it out on the ground underneath my stand so that when deer cut my wind, they would smell human, but they would also smell an attractant, a deer-related attractant, synthetic stuff. And I have seen that slow a deer's spook response down enough, and I've seen them walk through it too. Not necessarily with this stuff. I didn't see it happen this week.
Seen it.
Okay, so
I've seen it work with doe estrus back when we could use real doe estrus, and even the synthetic stuff. I've had a doe come directly downwind. I had poured a big swab of doe estrus onto the ground. So that doe scent, strong, unnaturally strong doe scents on the ground. A deer cuts my wind. The doe just locks up and just goes into, holy cow, what's happening? I smell a human. But then she's like, and I smell a deer, and kind of freaks out for a while and then moves on through past your scent. I've seen it happen. Not common. Most of the time they spook.
Gary, what do you think about?
Hey, I want to hear your rebuttal.
That's the whole thing I've been wanting to hear.
I'm not. What I'm saying is not the whole truth. I know that.
We know that. Let's hear the.
So why would you use scent control? Tell me when it would work.
If you're a terrible hunter, is the reason. I'm being honest with you. I mean, when I first started hunting, I really didn't even hardly know what a deer track looked like. Mm-hmm. You know, I just knew some guys told me about it, taught me how to shoot a bow. They couldn't kill deer. So I looked at it like a chess game. I thought, this is going to be like a chess game. And I thought, you know, I've got to be clean. I've got to be able to shoot my bow. But as time went on, I saw very few deer that I spooked. I mean, I had a big 10 point that I knew where my wind was going. And he came under my stand. And by the way, I was asleep. I was sound asleep, and I looked. Opened one eye about every 5 minutes. I looked at it, and so I knew he was going straight into my wind. I mean, so I'm not stupid about wind and about scent. And I knew he was gonna spook in a minute, because I'd had a doe come in and hit my wind, and I was only about 18 feet up. But anyway, if you're 20 to 24 feet and you're in pretty flat ground, you can get away with lots of stuff. And usually when you're hunting big bucks, you don't know which way they're coming from. I mean, you think you know.
Right.
But they'll surprise you. So why not be clean if you've got the energy and the time and the desire to do it?
Maybe it'll work.
It will help. And if you listen to John, he says if you're wearing a beard, you got long hair, forget it.
Yep.
Go hunt however you want to, because it don't work.
I would love to debate that guy.
No, don't even say that, Clay. I mean, this guy is one of the best hunters in the stinking country. And, I mean,
if you hunt 30 feet up.
Well, I mean, hey, you'd be taking on the wrong bulldog with this guy. I'm telling you, he knows his stuff. Now you know you don't have to do all this stuff, but it sure doesn't hurt anything, and a lot of times it helps. It's just part of my bailiwick, and you know. I mean, you can go at it so many. There's so many ways to skin a cat.
My deal was I realized that I was spending. You know, you only have so much energy in your life to spend towards hunting, and I was spending 30% of my energy towards scent control, and it wasn't the limiting factor of my hunting. So I became a better hunter in other places and spent less money, more time. Yeah. So I mean, if in a perfect world you would utilize some level of scent control, and perhaps it would reduce your human odor.
You know, if you study carbon and what it'll do, you almost know it works. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's in everything.
Carbon's amazing.
It's just activated carbon. It's just crazy good.
Yeah.
So if you understand what it's doing and you understand how to activate it and you got yourself covered, but you don't cover your head, well, I mean, they're going to smell you.
Yeah.
So you cover your head. Then you go, well, is your face covered? So I don't go to that extreme. I don't cover my face, but there's so many different ways to do it.
Me and Dad love talking about this.
So, you know, who knows which is best?
Gary, you're saying no beard, no hair.
No beard, no hair, and cover your entire body and wear rubber boots. And it if you got the energy to do it, it doesn't
you know
hurt.
What Mark Kenyon will say
a long time ago, and I've been
and
doing
backtracked.
It.
And you're killing
Listen,
deer, man.
You're up in a tree in a ghillie suit.
What Mark Kenyon says, he says it simply, and it's the same thing Dad says, is that if it might help you, if it might make a buck stay there for 5 seconds longer before he spooks, because there is an argument to be made, and I've yet to hear a single human give me a scientific reason that this is true. And I don't believe it, that a smaller amount of scent would spook a deer any more than a larger amount of scent. Because that is the thing that we're saying. We're saying you can't, we're saying like if you use scent control products, Dan, you're reducing your human odor. So a deer comes downwind and he still smells a human, he just smells less human.
Well, it's less volume, it's a gas, so it dissipates the further out it gets, the more it's dissipated.
What Clay Newcomb says is that it don't matter if he smells a little human or a lot of human, he's going to spook just the same about 90% of the time.
But I just made that number up, number one. Number two, by
90%
the time,
of all statistics are
Do you see
up.
What I'm saying, though?
But I see what you're saying, but the less there is and the further it dissipates,
okay.
There's a chance he might not smell nothing.
Well, I'm going off, I want to say decades, probably 13 years of messing around with scent control, and I have used the ozone products, okay, just begged them to work. I mean, I wanted ozone to work so bad because it was going to be my silver bullet. And it just, I have deer smell me all the time when I use ozone.
It makes an odor. It creates its own odor. And it might not be a human odor, but a buck goes, wait a minute, I've never smelt that before, so I'm getting out of here.
I mean, and I've heard that before. It definitely, you smell it when it's going. And I heard a real good bow hunter, a guy that I know that's killed 300 deer, white-tailed deer with a bow, who's killed multiple 200-inch deer. You'd never know his name. He's not a public figure. And he told me that ozone was a joke. I mean, he's a stone-cold killer. You know who I'm talking about. He hunted.
I think so.
And, I mean, he's the one that he said, that stuff's a joke. That's what he told me.
It's because it puts off an odor.
And then I've tried it for several years. My point is, and I don't have any trouble. I mean, this is what I think. Like now, you'll see me. I used Scent Shield this week. Sprayed down my clothes a little bit. Just I call it witchcraft. Because you're doing something that you know doesn't work.
I can do a whole podcast on this. Is baking soda witchcraft? Baking soda, number one, is in the Bible. So you're going to want to think about that.
I think witchcraft is too, for what it's worth.
It's bad.
You know, what Gary says about activated charcoal is true. I have a friend who has a propensity to make a pretty significant odor himself.
Mm.
Have you guys ever heard of the product Subtle Butt?
No, negative.
They are activated carbon sheets that go in your drawers.
Wow.
we talking furniture drawers or like
not furniture drawers
on my person?
Do they work?
Under drawers.
Yeah.
I don't want to know.
I love the scent control conversation. I don't want it to sound like I'm trying to stir up trouble, but it bothers me that there's no way that we can prove it. I mean, I could talk to you for an hour nonstop about all the reasons why commercial scent control products pretty much don't work. So anyway, I know I'm burning all these bridges.
Straw man argument. But I don't care about the commercial ones. It's wash your clothes in baking soda. Use some of that soap that doesn't have a whole lot
put
of scent in it.
It
makes
sense.
Baking
soda in your beard.
I dare you to put baking soda in my beard.
Hey, let's talk about Borderlands Jaguars.
Do they use a lot of scent control?
You know what? There is some theories on predators' ability to minimize scent. You know, in the animal kingdom, animals use scent for communication. So like a buck in the rut, he increases his odor so that his scent picture is bigger and yada yada. And I've heard it said that the predators can kind of like turn down their scent. We know that a white-tailed fawn and these fawns, when they're born like basically scentless, less odor. And their mother cleans them.
Wait a minute. So less odor equals advantage.
Mm. I just disproved myself.
Rewind. Hey, go ahead and edit that 30 minutes out.
Okay. Here's what I would say. I would love for someone to convince me that I'm wrong. So please do. Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Well, why is the burden on us?
Let's just say that.
But I mean, it's.
The reviews are going to go wild this week.
Yes. I would love for someone with a scientific answer that had 30 years of experience that wasn't drunk on their own spurious correlations.
I was about to defend Clay. I don't know if I want to do it now. But I was going to say, in the defense of you're bringing that up, the reduction in scent is to stave off predators, not to be a predator. So you're saying that the fawns have less of a scent, so they are less susceptible to predators or less detectable
rather than
you being the predator reducing your scent. So,
yeah. You're right, Dan. Reducing your scent is good. It's going to be good.
One more flip-flop. I don't even know who you are.
Hey, Borderlands Jaguars. Dan, what do you think?
I thought it was great. I loved hearing more from Warner Glenn. I think that was fantastic. I think anytime you hear that guy, I think it was very interesting to hear just the whole idea of there being an animal out there that's basically called the one that eats us.
Yeah.
Psychologically, that doesn't happen a whole lot to people.
Yeah.
And an animal, I mean, there's kind of these freak encounters, but there's an animal that's named that. That's a
eater of us.
Yeah, eater of us. That's pretty wild.
I thought you were just being dramatic. I didn't realize until I listened to the podcast, but I saw that on the title of the, when it popped up on my phone, and I thought, that's a little melodramatic, Clay.
it's what that tribe in Amazon, they called the Jaguaria.
Mm-hmm.
They called it eater of us. But in modern times, at least in the United States, there's never, I'm quite certain there's never been a documented jaguar attack in the United States, but down in Central America and stuff, like it's for real.
A lot of the American jaguars are vegan.
Yeah. Josh, what do you think?
Well, I thought it was really good. I love hearing the science, but I'm kind of with Dan too. I love hearing Warner Glenn. That guys like that are disappearing into hear stories about. That's what the thing that I like about him is the pursuit that he has of the thing that he does for the mountain lions and you know, finding the jaguar and stuff, but to really draw in family to talk about bringing people together, just you can tell the passion and the care and the concern that he has for the animal, the way that he talked about it with such reverence. Doesn't have a bloodlust for animals. He really has a passion for these animals and, you know, conservation and awareness, even the way that he's like, I didn't know if I should go public with this.
Yeah.
You know, just shows an incredible respect for the people around him, for the animal itself, for conservation. And it was very, very interesting to listen to. I really enjoyed it.
I want to clarify something. So I put this picture. So in Warner Glenn's house, he has this huge, probably, I bet it's 6 foot long, 5 foot tall, at original painting that a really good artist did of the picture that he took of the jaguar. So the jaguar is in the pose that he saw the jaguar, but the artist, you know, put a little Warner Glenn down in the corner riding his mule.
Oh, really?
Yeah. If you see that, there's Warner Glenn down there with a dog. And I made an Instagram post and said Warner Glenn documented the first live jaguar in the United States. And several people were like, no, he didn't. There were so many killed in Arizona and so many killed in Texas. And people were like, you may want to go back and read that. And I was like, okay, listen to what was said. He documented the first live one. So if someone shows up with a dead one in the back of his truck, that is not a documentation of a live jaguar. That is a dead jaguar. It was the first documentation of a live jaguar in the United States, meaning he took a photo, went back and showed the photo to people, and that animal was still alive. So that's all it was. But they hadn't documented one in...
What's the lifespan of a jaguar?
You know, that's a good question, and I don't know. Probably about like a...
20 years, maybe?
Black bear. I doubt they live 20 years in the wild. Probably like a cat.
Interesting.
Like a tomcat, you know, live 12 years or something.
Just 12 to 15.
This idea that there could be a animal like that that lives. I mean, a jaguar is a jungle animal. It's just such a wild thing. What did you think of it, Dad?
Oh, I thought it was very interesting. And, of course, Warner Glenn was interesting to listen to. And you know, he wasn't satisfied with your comment that the first live jaguar that was seen, he broke it down further.
What did he say?
He said, I can't remember, really.
He corrected.
But yeah. He said, it's alive. It was wild. It was wild in nature. In other words, you can see them in captivity. You could see them dead.
The first live wild jaguar. Yeah,
So he wasn't happy with your simple alive jaguar. He went into...
Yeah,
it's
he said
in the
live wild jaguar.
Now, he
United
did
States.
Two or three different breakdowns on it. So, I mean, he eliminated the zoo... So I thought, you know, he's a detail guy. I mean, he's really paying attention to details. But what caught me about the whole thing was kind of surprising, really, as much interesting content as there was. But what stuck with me is the fringe animals. I mean, to me, that was just like Daniel Boone all over again.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I mean, you got an animal that has been created this way where you got a bunch of little crazy guys out here. And their job is to go find the boundary of where we can survive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've never even thought of that. I mean, that's crazy. And the way you brought it out, these were like the pioneers?
The frontiersmen of the species.
Yeah. And I go, wow, that is pretty stinking cool.
You think about, yeah, I'm glad you said that. Think about it. A jaguar, he has no concept that he is on the northern range of his species. He doesn't know that. In Brazil and in Bolivia and Venezuela is the core of his, like, if I went down there, there'd be a bunch of us there. This jaguar is just living his life. And he goes north into the United States. And there just comes a point when he's just like, I got to go back south. You know, and there might be some functional things that happen. Like he runs into cities, less game, more arid, you know, whatever the conditions. But he has this... He has this metric inside of him that's default where there comes a point when he goes no further and he goes back.
That's me just about every time I get to our in-laws, every time I get to my in-laws' house, it's like, nope, just
gotta
go back south.
Go back south in Michigan.
Well, Clay, it's really a tremendous survival technique. It's like, you know, we can all live here in this tremendous jungle forest and just, you know, be having a great life. But what happens if the forest is gone? So,
right.
I mean, I need to expand my territory where that we can survive regardless of what happens.
Yeah.
And so it's innate within some of those guys to be the frontiersman that's going to go out and find that fringe area, find out where the border is. And it's, that's how they stay alive. That's how they have survived.
Well, there have been jaguars documented as far north as the Grand Canyon. And, hey, did you hear me call out you and Aunt Ollie?
Oh, yeah.
Hey, okay, I've got to say this. in this book, so I wanted to talk about this book. I wasn't able to, I just couldn't fit it into the Bear Grease podcast, but there's a book called Borderlands Jaguars by David E. Brown and Carlos Lopez Gonzalez. Incredible book. Sometimes you pick up these smaller books like this and, you know, you might be unimpressed with kind of the writing and the structure of the book. This is like a top-notch, a top-shelf academic book. Most of the information that I got from the for the podcast came from this book, Borderlands Jaguars.
You mean Tigres de la Frontera.
Yeah, yeah. That was good. That was really good.
Where did you hear about Del Lee from?
I've heard about Dale Lee for years. If you're in the hound community, you've heard of Dale Lee.
I thought he was hands down my favorite part of this podcast.
Oh,
that
man.
Storytelling.
Dale
and
Lee.
I was curious, when he started, I just thought, where on earth did Clay, where does he find these people?
Yeah.
How did you hear about him?
I bet you liked him, did you, Dad?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He was, so Dale Lee is considered, you know, one of the best lion hunters of all time. And that's so hard to say. I told Steve Rinella the other day about Warner Glenn before I interviewed him, and I said, Warner Glenn's one of the best dry ground lion hunters in the world. And Steve said, why do dry ground lion hunters get to, why do they all of a sudden get like they're the best in the world? And I stopped and I was like, you know,
because there's like four of them.
We say that all the time. But Dale Lee is known as this great hunter, but he was for sure known as the lead man in catching jaguars in Mexico. And I mean, if you want to talk about some wild stuff, talk about going to Mexico with a pack of hounds and these custom boats. Did you hear him say, we had these little canoes. Actually, it's a flat-bottom boat with plywood and plastic glass.
Yeah.
Plexiglass.
Yes. Yeah.
He called it plastic glass.
I loved it.
He told it. I said it on the podcast, but he told a story. A hunting story like he was calling a horse race.
Yeah.
We were coming down through there, and the dog said, that little cur dog said, yippee, 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 yip. And I knew that jaguar was a-coming. And then we went down through there, and there he was up in a tree. And the old Iowa farmer, he was, I mean, his voice would ascend and then descend.
He did not sound Texan. He sounded straight out of Arkansas.
Yeah, I thought the same. He's from
Arkansas
Arizona.
Yeah.
Oh, what a guy. Hey, there are 15 hours of tapes that you can get of Dale Lee telling stories. Brett Vaughn, you can buy it from my buddy Brett Vaughn, born 100 years too late is his Instagram handle. I mean, I have the tapes. Brett just sent me some, but I haven't listened to them all. That Jaguar call was something, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It sounded good.
Yeah. Made out of an empty melon and
a gourd.
And what did he pull through it?
A piece of leather with rosin, some kind of rosin on the leather. Ty, what's did anything stand out to you inside of it?
Yeah, I definitely can relate to what everyone else has said. I also thought about just conceptually, there comes a point because we, you know, as the Jaguar's kind of gone up and further away out of Mexico, you know, it's strong in the iconography of Mexico, but you don't see it at that borderline. And you mentioned how it's like when you see something rare, but it's not super rare, there's a place for it in the iconography. And it's like this like treasured moment. You saw the thing that we don't get to see a lot of. And then when it's super rare, to your point, it's just like somebody shows back up to the campfire and they're just like, I saw a jaguar. And it's like, shut up. What are you talking about? You ate some wild mushrooms. You didn't see a jaguar. And so it doesn't even make it into the iconography.
Yeah.
And so that was really cool to tie that back even to the Black Panther, like, storylines from all the way back with the first Bear Grease. And so like just looking at how wildlife and experiences are like captured within cultural things. And then like there even comes a point where it stops. Like it becomes so rare that it just doesn't even get captured or isn't even considered.
Yeah.
Like it's not even sacred. It's just not plausible. So why even,
you know,
draw it somewhere or write it somewhere?
There's a lot that's weighing on the fact that the tribes of the southwestern United States don't have jaguar iconography in their culture, because there are groups of there's a group right now, and I don't know all the details of it, but they have talked about jaguar quote reintroduction. There's a group that believes that there can be that southwest Arizona, southeast Arizona, southwest New Mexico could hold 60 to 100 jaguars, and they talked about releasing them into that area, which would be wild. And the biologist and everybody that I know is saying, like, why would we do that? They've never been here that much. And that's what Jim Heffelfinger was saying. Jim Heffelfinger is a biologist, and he's like, there's just no evidence that they were ever here in great number. And what Warner Glenn was saying was that if that happens, it just shuts down that part of the world for ranchers, for hunters, for people living off the land. And his point was well taken, and I liked it, and I wanted to put it in there. As he said, yeah, let's protect that cat. Put it on the endangered species list, which it has been for 40 years, 50 years, whatever. But he said that critical habitat regulation locks stuff down so much, it de-incentivizes people from even wanting them there. He said, then people shoot, shovel, and shut up.
Yeah, and I remember that phrase.
It may sound normal to think, well, of course Warner Glenn didn't shoot that jaguar. It wasn't normal. I mean, people shoot jaguars. I mean, I don't have proof of that, but there's in Mexico, they for sure do to this day. I mean, that's the biggest threat to them down in Mexico is, like Jim said, people, these small-time cattle ranchers.
It's their livelihood.
Killing jaguars.
He called them, was it? I want to say what he called it, reciprocity killings or something like that. There was a
retaliatory.
Yeah, and, like that. Even that kind of colors the nature of it when you recognize, like, they're not killing it for sport; they're killing it for retaliation because it's coming on their livelihood. But then they're just like, no, we got to protect them. It's just there's definitely
a conflict.
I'm
pretty sure that the Malpa Borderlands group, and I could be wrong on this, Alex, is. There are groups that pay landowners if they lose livestock to jaguars. So it's like, okay, you lost a cow. Don't go kill a jaguar. Let me pay you for the cow.
Yeah.
The replacement cost for it. So that is a big part of kind of the creative conservation that's going on, but where does that funding come from? And, I'm not a jaguar expert. I learned all this in the last 2 months, you know. I mean, so it's not like this is something, this is all new to me as well. But it's fascinating that we have a big cat in North America that is like that.
Did you notice that when you asked Jim if he had ever seen any documentation for a Black Panther, he did not directly answer the question?
I noticed.
You think he did?
Simple no.
Hey, I now remember what I was going to say about this book. I'm kind of just going off memory here. In this book, there is a map of the United States, and it was made a long, long time ago, and it shaded in places where jaguars were in the United States during this time. The entire state of Texas I got to find it, because it wasn't the entire state of Texas. But the jaguar distribution from this map, and biologists now would say that map wasn't accurate. But back in those days, they believed it. And the jaguar distribution went up and almost touched Arkansas. Hmm. So if there was a melanistic jaguar, now, he could have almost been in Arkansas.
Ollie and Allie, I mean, you can't argue with them, okay?
They saw one.
How long was its tail? How long did its tail sound?
Well, it sounded like it was the length of their body.
What's funny is, had I not heard that, though, like, I'm from Aransas Pass, Texas.
Oh, here it is right here. Look here. Okay. Range of jaguar in North and Central America, 1923, with the aid of the U.S. Biological Survey. That jaguar range comes up all the way into southeast Oklahoma and touches the Red River in southwest Arkansas. I mean, read it and weep, Alex.
Did you ever send Alex a hat?
We're bros. I haven't. I don't have hats anymore.
That's the one.
So there could
be. But Jim Heffelfinger says that there has never been a melanistic jaguar documented below deep, deep South Mexico.
Above deep South.
Yeah. There's never been one above it. Right. So black jaguar, kind of a stretch.
Okay. So Aransas Pass, Texas is where I grew up. And the high school mascot was Panthers.
Really?
Pass Panthers. And the Panther was a Black Panther.
All right.
A person in a Black Panther.
Leave it to Ty.
Wasn't in the cage. But here's what's funny is in the most remarkably South Texas thing ever, there was a seafood restaurant called the Big Fisherman. And outside the Big Fisherman was whoever owned that place was basically like Tiger King from the 1980s because there was a ton of wild animals and big cats and everything. And had you asked me before you told me there weren't Black Panthers, I said, yeah, I saw one in a cage outside of the Big Fisherman waiting to go in and eat fried shrimp. But like just because the iconography of it was still built into my head, my high school mascot was a Black Panther. There was Black Panthers there at the Big Fisherman. Like all of this was just baked in. It's just like, this is what it was. Happens. And so now I'm just like buried in lies. I don't know what's the truth anymore.
And you're not going to find it here. Oh, man.
You know what? Listen to these podcasts again. Reminded me of something that I had completely forgotten about. Circa 1986, my mom worked with this guy. My mom worked for DuPont in Texas, in Clear Lake, Texas, I think. Baytown, Texas. This guy, we lived in this town called Alvin, Texas, and this guy lived there. He had like Clydesdales, and he had some other interesting, and I think he had some alpacas and stuff. But he had a jaguar. He had a jaguar and he had a conversion van and he'd ride around with this pet jaguar in a cage in the back of his van. I saw it with my own eyes when I was a kid.
Did you have to ride in your underwear?
The cat didn't care what I smelled
different,
like.
Different.
How long and or curly was his mullet?
He wasn't actually. He was kind of looked like Grizzly Adams. He was kind of a cool guy. He'd put his team of Clydesdales together, and he'd ride his wagon with Clydesdales through town.
Wow.
Yeah. But yeah, he had a jaguar. I remember going, he said, you want to see my cat? And he took me.
Oh, wow. This is not the kind of guy you want to. How old were you?
I was 10.
Oh, wow.
And he'd open up the back of his van and he had a cage, like a kind of like a dog kennel in there with a jaguar in there.
Impressive. Impressive. Hey, okay. I think it's time. I've been sitting on some original music for some time.
deep in the bowels of your soul.
Hey, okay, me and Josh and Ty are going to play some music, okay? I wrote a song. I want to publicly state this, that has jaguars in it. I have no dreams of being a talented musician, okay? We like Good to play thing. Music because it's just fun. I have seen some people that like take music kind of serious and maybe they're not very good and you're like, so that's not me, okay? I realize I'm not very good, okay? But I do like music and I enjoy playing it. I wrote a serious song about Warner Glenn. And
what do you mean by serious?
I mean like all the other songs that we've written, like Oh Captain, Oh Captain, yeah. And the Bulldozer song. Mm-hmm. Like they were parodies, they were jokes.
The Bulldozer
was funny.
Song was, but the Captain song was great.
It was great.
Yeah. It was
great. Those were joke songs, and
it
so
wasn't
there's
a joke to
there's
me,
a line that you cross when you start writing serious songs.
He's essentially saying all this for me. I, you know, Clay is just about an inch away. When he started writing a serious song, I was concerned that maybe I had a YouTube diva. In my house.
I've been concerned about that for years.
And I got super nervous.
That's all my fault, Misty.
We're
going
to start doing this? But that's not what he's doing here.
So I wrote a song. It's called The Ballad of Warner Glenn. Okay. And I don't feel like I had a choice to write this song. I really was impacted by meeting Warner Glenn. And I sat down and wrote this song in like a very short amount of time. And Ty is going to play the stand-up bass, and Josh is going to help me on guitar, and we're going to sing the song. Dan, you ready to hear
it? Let's do it.
I'm ready.
Okay. They're going to just stare at Dan while they sing it.
Well, Dan's the only one that hadn't heard it. Dad's heard it a little bit, but yeah, we're going to do it.
I can get out the cowbell if y'all want me to.
Way down south on the border of Mexico, rattlesnakes, lots of banditos where the cactus grow. Dirt and spurs, feed the hounds and let them go. As a boy, Marvin taught him where the big toms rode. Open country where the jaguar strolls. Saddle a 16-hand mule when the desert sun glows. Nobody ever told him this wretched life was a hard road to hoe.
hiding the rising sun behind the Chiricahua's folds. He's mounted and moving and going for an all-day muleback stroll. Open country where the jaguar strolls. Lion track in the dirt, 7 miles in, but where did he go? Got a pack of white walker dogs that are philosophers like the road. Hounds work the dirt like a farmer works his rows. Up the canyon, round the rock, chasing the ghost of a shadow. Open country where the jaguar strolls. They'll only catch him if he crosses the plateau. Chase him over the rim rock, an old hook bays him in a hole. It's not a line he seeks, but a wildness he can't control. Who I'm talking about is Warner Glenn and the Black Crow. Open country where the jaguar strolls. Open country and sage makes the old man's heart grow. A poet in a saddle, but his words don't overflow. He fought a lawman and pleaded guilty, just so you know. Sweat some bullets and sleepless nights, but they let him go. Open country where the jaguar strolls. A lesser man would have thrown another blow. But Warner knew to solve his problems he had to grow. Invited his enemies to the table and their faces glowed. Broke some bread, all were fed, and the rooster crowed. Open country where the jaguar strolls.
Hey, man. That's excellent.
That was awesome.
Yeah.
Open country. Hey, I want to read these lyrics because if you follow along on these three podcasts, this is a story. It's a story of a lion hunt. The way down south on the border of Mexico. I mean, Warner Glenn literally lives on the Mexican border. Rattlesnakes, lots of banditos where the cactus grow. He gets horses snake bit and dogs snake bit. When I was down there with him for a day, he was like, watch out for rattlesnakes. Dirt and spurs, feed the hounds and let them go. I mean, the man's life revolves around his dogs. And I noted when he rode his mule just on an average day, like when I rode with him, he put on his spurs, which I don't always wear my spurs, but he put on his spurs. So dirt and spurs, feed the hounds and let them go. And as a boy, Marvin taught him where the big toms rove. Marvin is his dad. And Marvin, he hunts the same ground his dad did.
Hmm.
I mean, he the exact same ground. And then open country where the jaguars stroll. That's the chorus. Open country is the phrase that they use. Like when I went down there, I heard multiple people say open country. And then I tuned in. I was like, ah, that's what you guys say. That means something. Their book's called Open Country. Warner says it all the time. Open country, where the jaguars stroll. It defines that landscape, this visitor from the south. Saddle a 16-hand mule when the desert sun glows. So that means early in the morning. Nobody ever told him this wretched life was a hard road to hoe. Man, I tell you what, when I think of a guy like Warner Glenn hunting as long as he has, I think about I said it on the podcast, but I think about the number of times he hooked up his trailer in the dark, woke up at literally 2 a.m., to go feed his mules, load his dogs, drive 2 hours, get the mules out, and then be where he needs to go by sunrise to look for a track. Hiding the rising sun behind the Chiricahua's folds. Warner is one of these guys that wakes up like early every single day. Chiricahua's is the mountains that they live in and hunt. So hiding the rising sun behind the Chiricahua's folds. He's mounted and moving and going for an all-day muleback stroll. Lying track in the dirt 7 miles in, but where did he go? They ride a tremendous amount, you know, when they're riding these hunts. And this is my favorite line. He's got a pack of white walker dogs that are philosophers like Thoreau. Hounds work the dirt like a farmer works his rows, up a canyon, round the rock, chasing the ghost of a shadow.
I liked that line a lot. Hounds work the dirt like a farmer works his rows.
Yeah. They only catch him if he crosses the plateau, chase him over the rim rock, and old Hook bays him in a hole. Hook is his favorite dog, the 12-year-old dog, you know? Mm-hmm. It's not a line he seeks, but a wildness he can't control. I think that's true. I mean, like, when I think of the things that I'm after, like a big buck in a mountain, I mean, like, I want antlers, I want meat, but really what I want to do is interact with a wild place. Mm-hmm. That's really what you're after, you know? And in a hunter, being able to interact with a wild place by taking something from it is, like, super human and super intimate. So it's not a lion he seeks, but a wildness he can't control. Who I'm talking about is Warner Glenn, the Black Crow.
What's the Black Crow? Where's the Black Crow tie? Okay,
Let me start that over. Who I'm talking about is Warner Glenn and the Black Crow. I'm just saying Warner Glenn is like, he's like part of the landscape, like a Black Crow.
Just
is.
Like a Black Crow. Okay, that's right.
Open country and sage makes the old man's heart grow. A poet in a saddle, but his words don't
overflow. That was my other favorite line.
Yeah.
You can just have saddle, one but his favorite line.
He fought a lawman and pleaded guilty, just so you know. Sweat some bullets and sleepless nights, but they let him go. What good cowboy story doesn't have a little squabble
it's
with
a part,
law?
It's about a quarter country song, as it should be.
A lesser man would have thrown another blow, but Warner knew to solve his problems he had to grow, invited his enemies to the table, and their faces glowed, broke some bread, all were fed, and the rooster crowed.
I like that last chorus verse.
Well, we're done with the Warner Glenn series. So,
thanks, Warner Glenn.
Yeah, it was good. Really good.
Mm-hmm.
Really good.
I hope he lives a lot longer. I remember him talking about this might be our last season, him and his old dog.
Yeah.
I have my doubts.
He's got a lot of life left in him, I can tell you that. Closing thoughts, Dan?
Bet Warner Glenn's pretty concerned about scent control.
Covers the dogs in baking soda.
Ty, thanks for coming, man.
Yeah, you bet. I was glad to do it. I've enjoyed the series on Warner Glenn for sure. He's the kind of person that hearing about their life, like, just kind of sparks in you a desire to get out there and do it more, and not get kind of caught up. You know, I hunt and everything, but I'm on a computer 90% of my all my working day and everything, and there's something in you that's not fulfilled, and so to hear about people who make their living that kind of way, it's just like, you know, that may not be for me, but it definitely drives me to want to make sure that I'm staying in touch with the things that are tied to that, so that I'm not just kind of getting caught up in computers and college football and such nonsense.
I hear you. Dad, thoughts?
Oh, it's just awesome. You know, great guy, legend, and a neat animal. Love the animal, the big head, the strong jaw that can bend a half inch steel. I'm going like, likes to eat us, huh?
Yeah.
Very interesting, very, very informative.
Good one. Hey, the next Bear Grease podcast are going to be really cool. More coming. I'm not going to tell you what it is, though. Hey, thanks for listening.
But if you guys want to call me, I'll tell you.
Yeah, Josh was there. Keep the wild places wild.
Hey, we miss Brent.
Oh, yeah.
Brent, come back to us.
Yeah, Brent. I forgot to say Brent wasn't here.
Yeah. And Warner Glenn's daughter was extremely interesting.
Yes, enjoyed that
a lot, too.
Yeah, Kelly.
Yeah.
For sure. All right. Thank you, guys. Scent control or no scent control. Love you all.
You stink.